Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Understanding Resistance in Chronic HCV Infection, Lessons Learned from HIV and HPV, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Stephen L. Flam, MD, Jeffrey Burak, MD, MPP, B. Phil, and Nancy Rowe, MD. Dr. Flam is a professor of medicine, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Medical Director of Liver Transplantation, Northwestern Memorial Hospital, Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Flam has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Vertex Pharmaceuticals Incorporated and Merck & Company. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Vertex Pharmaceuticals Incorporated and Merck & Company. He received grants for clinical research from Vertex Pharmaceuticals Incorporated and Merck & Company. Dr. Flam does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Flam does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Burak is an Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine, University of California, Berkeley, and University of California, San Francisco, Medical Director, East Bay AIDS Center, Alta Bates Summit Medical Center, Berkeley, California. Dr. Burak has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Monogram Biosciences. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Gilead Sciences, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Janssen Pharmaceutical Products, and Vive Healthcare. He received grants for clinical research from Gilead Sciences. Dr. Burak does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Burak does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Rowe is an Associate Professor of Medicine, Staff Physician in Medicine, University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Rowe has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for Gilead Sciences, Vertex Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, and Roche. Dr. Rowe does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Rowe does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to empower clinicians to optimize long-term patient outcomes by proactively addressing the issue of antiviral drug resistance. This activity is supported by Monogram Biosciences. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Jeffrey Burak, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at University of California, San Francisco and Berkeley, and Medical Director of the East Bay AIDS Center in Oakland, California. Welcome to this CME certified activity titled Understanding Resistance in Hepatitis C, Lessons Learned from HIV and Hepatitis B. I'd like to introduce my colleagues today, Dr. Stephen L. Flam, Professor of Medicine at the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine and Medical Director of Liver Transplantation at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago, and Dr. Nancy Rowe, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. When we talk about resistance to antiviral drugs, Steve, I know you've had a really nice analogy for understanding the very basic idea of how viruses become resistant to drugs. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Sure, Jeff. I mean, it's a simplistic model in my mind how I picture resistance, but When you think about it, a virus enzyme has a three-dimensional conformation. And the virus enzymes are critical for replication of the virus. And if you somehow can inhibit the enzyme, you can lower the replication rate and therefore lower the viral level. If you envision the enzyme as a three-dimensional structure with the active site having a certain conformation, it's almost like a lock. And then I envision the medicine, which is designed to fit into the lock, like a key. And if everything is right, the lock and the key fit in perfectly. The key inhibits the ability of the lock, the enzyme, to work, and then the virus is unable to replicate well, and that's what causes the viral load to drop. So that's how I envision resistance to medications for organisms like viruses.
So what happens to the lock and key in a resistant situation?
So in a resistant situation, the enzyme has a mutation, usually in that active site, and therefore the lock may make a slight change. And the key, which of course stays the same because it's the medicine, doesn't fit in well anymore. It may fit in a little bit, it may not fit in at all. And because that lock and key don't fit together perfectly anymore, the virus enzyme and then the virus itself is able to escape the inhibition by that medication. The enzyme can start working again, the virus can replicate again, and then the viral load starts to go back up.
Thanks. We've learned a lot about drug resistance from HIV in the last 20 years of clinical experience. With HIV, we have a rapidly replicating virus that's prone to make errors in replicating itself. And we know that these errors can cause mutations, many of which are detrimental to the virus, but some of which may help it escape from either immunologic control or drug control. This is particularly likely to happen when there is not quite enough drug around to suppress the viral replication, but enough to exert selective pressure on future generations of virions. So we've learned from that in HIV that we need multiple different drugs targeting different points in the HIV life cycle, or at least points that are where cross-resistance with one another does not occur. The drugs often have overlapping toxicities and interactions with each other, and we've learned the importance of optimizing drug treatment to maintain drug levels, particularly the importance of drug adherence. Nancy, could you let us know how is HCV similar to HIV in some of these ways, and in what other ways does it differ?
Absolutely. I think that it's important to understand that we need to benefit from the lessons that you would learn from another viral mechanism or viral structure, but to recognize the uniqueness of each and every virus. So the examples we're most familiar with, not only HIV, but also hepatitis B, and we try to translate those lessons to hep C. The most important thing is the similarities that they are all very high producing viruses. Each one of them is capable of reproducing itself in entirety and making mistakes while it does that. The way it escapes the immune system, drug pressures, anything that changes, the virus has to change to adapt to that. And, you know, there's bad proofreading, there's mistakes that are made that are good, like you were suggesting, and then there are mistakes that lead to virus that's not very fit and that dies off. But the most important thing is that all three of these are prone to virus errors. All three of these viruses are very, very high producing. And this is important for viral fitness. The more active you are and the more mistakes you make, the more likely your virus is still going to be there at the end of the day. When we look at the differences, though, hepatitis C is unique in that it doesn't have a mechanism of saving or memorizing these mutations. So HIV integrates itself into the host DNA. Hepatitis B might do that, but certainly protects itself in a very sequestered way in the nucleus. And when the cells divide, the new cells carry along this genetic information time and time again. Hepatitis C never makes it into the nucleus. It's all the replication is within the cytoplasm, and because of that, it doesn't have the ability to integrate itself into the host DNA, and it doesn't have the ability to save those mistakes as the cells divide over time. And this very much impacts resistance and how we imagine resistance in HIV and Hep B.
So let me ask you, in HIV, we have the concept of archived resistance, where changes that have occurred in the viral genome are integrated, as you said, into host DNA, we have the idea that once you've developed resistance to a drug, you always have to be presumed to be resistant to that drug. Is that not the same in Hep C?
Well, unfortunately, with hepatitis C, we've been a bit of cavemen. So interferon and ribavirin, which I know we are going to address, have not really had resistance, and so we've never paid much attention to that. In such a naive environment, our feelings, or the hypothesis, is that there is no way that hepatitis C can archive itself. But I think it's only going to be over time that we truly understand if selecting for mutations or if these mistakes really will be longer lived than what we think that they might be.
So where are we today in therapy? You mentioned interferon and ribavirin. There have obviously been a lot of changes in the last couple of years in hepatitis C therapy.
So right now, we've only been adding onto therapy. So you gave us such an eloquent model of how you can design a fit medication regimen for a patient and their virus. For us, we've taken, you know, the backbone of first interferon, making our interferon a little bit more resilient, a little more sophisticated, then adding ribavirin. And now we have a third class of agents that we're capable of using, but we're not able to get rid of the other two without losing response. So that if we look at the backbone, interferon, pegylated interferon, our interferons are cytokines. They're naturally made. And we believe that the most global way of describing them is through a mechanism of immune modulation. Obviously, months and months of NIH research, years, has gone into elucidating that mechanism. But it still seems to be more immunologic. Ribavirin does have many, many mechanisms, probably most of which we don't fully understand. We know it's a weak polymerase. We know it offers mutagenic potential. And we also know that it boosts the immune response. So which of these is most important for hepatitis C? I think we probably have at least two different opinions at the table, maybe three opinions at the table. But I don't think we know the right answer for that. The important thing is, and I'm sure as the discussion goes on, is that we cannot get rid of ribavirin in our backbone of therapy yet, and has been a limitation to even some of the development of future therapy. These two mechanisms are not prone to resistance. So some patients may be more sensitive or less sensitive to interferon or ribavirin's actions, but using these medications does not change the host so that they can no longer be used again as effectively.
Mm-hmm. What about the new drugs, the direct-acting antivirals?
That's why we're having this discussion, because this is a very new place for hepatitis C. The direct-acting antivirals are targeting, as Steve was saying, a very specific mechanism. And because the virus itself can change and changes rapidly, it's capable of making those minute conformation changes that then make the new agent less effective. And what we need to do is to understand how we can use therapy in that context.
Mm-hmm. To amplify what Nancy said, I think the important part is that why we haven't discussed resistance in hepatitis C to date is the fact that the medications we've been using for the last 15 or so years don't incur resistance because they don't act directly on the virus. And that's why resistance doesn't occur. Now, very many medications that in the pipeline that we're going to talk about later, including the two that were just approved, are targeted directly against one of the viral enzymes. And it's important to know, too, that the virus has many enzymes that help replicate it. The two that were approved were just approved against one of the enzymes, a protease.
Which protease is that?
It's the NS3-4A protease. Mm-hmm. And therefore, mutations in that enzyme, in that part of the Hep C genome, are the ones that can confer resistance to the medications that we have now. When we have new medications, which we'll discuss a little bit later, different enzyme mutations would theoretically confer resistance to them. Mm-hmm. So resistance is a concept we're going to have to deal with, not only with the medicines that we have just had the great fortune to have approved, but also with many of the new medications that are going to be forthcoming.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the development of some of these mutations. In HIV, we look for resistance in a couple of different ways. One is to look at genomic mutations that have been associated with drug resistance by genotypic testing. And the other is to try to look more directly at enzyme function with phenotypic testing. Do we have those same sort of tests in HCV?
Well, we have some of those tests. So that in the research models, companies have looked at both genotypic as well as phenotypic models. But we are fortunate or confused by having the ability to actually order genotypic testing for hepatitis C. It is a genotypic test, not a phenotypic test, and it also is only accurate if in the population of hepatitis C, there's at least a 20% prevalence of the mutation. Levels lower than that, we know are there. I mean, theoretically, every single potential mistake should be present, and if we look hard enough, we should be able to see it. So the genotypic test has limitations that you need to understand, but we can order that.
So in research settings, when you do deep sequencing or clonal sequencing, would you find different mutations that you're not seeing on population sequencing?
You certainly could. And again, you know, I think to the uninitiated, when you think about looking at resistance in a patient, at first thought, you might think that the test looks for a single resistant mutation in a patient. While every single virus in a patient is not examined in a test, they check a certain number of clones of virus in a particular patient, and then they check to see by a certain test how frequent the level of assessment of the test assess mutations if they occur in a certain frequency. That's it. Mm-hmm. So population sequencing, which is the easiest to do as I gather, detects mutations only at a rate of approximately 20%, as you mentioned. Now clonal sequencing looks at a much lower level, such as approximately 5% of a population to have mutations where you would identify it. Then they have ultra deep sequencing that looks at an even deeper level where you can detect resistant mutations at even a lower level. So it's important to understand the tests a little bit, not only because when research studies get presented and you hear about it so you actually understand them, but there's of course the clinical implications. And should you or should you not order a test? Does it have any impact? And we'll discuss that too in a few
minutes. Well, let's move to that, because in HIV, the identification of what are called resistance-associated mutations. In HCV, we talk about resistance-associated variants. In other words, subspecies of virus that have been associated with drug resistance. In HIV, we've learned that we have to test for the presence of those mutations at baseline, either before therapy is initiated or ideally even when the patient is first comes to attention as being HIV positive, because of the risk that they have what's called primary or transmitted drug resistance. In other words, they've been infected with an HIV virus that already has some drug resistance. What do we know, Nancy, about whether that's an issue in HCV?
So there's what we know about it today, and there's what we know about what it might become in the future. But it's important to know that today, no matter how wonderful the direct-acting antiviral that we can add to our current therapy is, it is added to our current therapy. And as Steve was saying, interferon and ribavirin don't have associated resistance. So having the presence of a resistant associated variant doesn't imply that that variant would not be sensitive to interferon and ribavirin. Probably the best way of looking at this is looking at the data that we know exists. Mm-hmm. And as Steve was saying, we can find baseline resistance testing. When Bisepavir looked at their entire population, they identified 66 patients that had baseline resistance variants that should potentially impact their treatment course. But when they looked at these patients very carefully, they found that it was only the combination of the pre-existing major variant combined with a baseline insensitivity to interferon and ribavirin that could predict that patient that was going to fail therapy and fail therapy with a resistant variant.
So these were the patients who responded poorly during the four-week lead-in phase?
They responded poorly to lead-in phase, and they had pre-existing identified variants. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like it could be very important, but when you looked at the population of nearly 1,000, over 1,000 Bisepavir-treated patients, it was about 1% of the total population. So you would be doing a lot of testing to identify 1%, and then you wouldn't have the information about interferon sensitivity. Our IL-28B testing can suggest some of that, but it is not accurate enough to predict those who are going to have null response.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's a lot we still don't know about the clinical utility of resistance testing. Nancy was speaking about resistance-associated variants that can be detected at baseline. Steve, what do we know about the emergence of drug resistance during HCV therapy?
Well, not surprisingly, when you see the emergence of these RAVs or resistant associated variants during therapy, it is highly associated with failure of therapy. So whereas some patients who have the baseline mutations actually still respond to therapy, the fact that you acquire them on therapy or when you acquire them on therapy is a very bad sign. And that usually, again, is associated with failure of your therapy. So it behooves us when we treat patients to really try to limit the development of resistance because, again, if we implement strategies to do so, we can be more successful, hopefully, at achieving our target, which is a sustained virologic response. Now, the other issue, which we may be discussing in a few minutes, is if you do get resistance, unfortunately, what are the implications of that over the long term? Because that's the other clinical implication of resistance, not necessarily just the failure of the therapeutic regimen that you're now doing, but are there implications? The fact that archiving, which you were discussing earlier, doesn't seem to happen with hepatitis C, might imply that the long-term implications of resistance may not be profound. However, we don't know that the answer to that question yet because the data on resistance, because these medications are so new, is so early.
But we also know that a mutation can affect the fitness of the virus. So although watching long-term after you stop the medication does suggest that it returns closer to the population that it started. If you allow enough compensatory mutations to occur, you could actually select a variant that is very fit and may not go away. And it's not because of archiving. It's simply a reflection of the fitness. So that you want to identify the person who's going to fail therapy, not necessarily through just resistance testing, but if you don't stop the drug and you continue to offer that pressure, compensatory mutations will occur and you're going to even change that virus further.
Now we hear a lot about futility rules in hepatitis C treatment and trying to stop therapy promptly when a patient remains viremic. Is that the reason? Are there other reasons that we need to pay attention to that?
Well, if you ever treat a patient with interferon and ribavirin, even without adding the direct antiviral, the ability to stop an expensive medication that has side effects at a time when it's inevitably not going to work is certainly going to benefit the patient as well as medical costs, office staff that are trying to maintain that patient. So the earliest you can find a patient whose therapy is ineffective, mm-hmm. whether it's at a cost to future therapy or just a simple cost to that person themselves, is an advantage.
Absolutely. I mean, we have always had futility rules, for at least the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the reasons to stop the medicine are, as Nancy just said, because A, the medicines cost a lot, and B, they have a lot of side effects. Mm-hmm. And if they're not working, why should you expose a patient to them? And by the way, this is very common. People really have not in the past followed the futility rules religiously like I think they should have. However, it's even more important now because when you have treatment failure, the vast majority, if not all, patients develop resistance. And I think what Nancy was referring to, the longer you expose a patient to a medication like a direct-acting antiviral agent that isn't working because there is already resistance, may allow you to make additional mutations which make that resistant enzyme even more difficult to block. And if that enzyme persists, if it leads to a fit virus, or if it somehow persists over the long term, it could have implications for future medical therapy because of a term that we use called cross-resistance, where you now have resistance that you created earlier to a medication that comes down the road later. So it is imperative that when patients violate futility rules, that they are adhered to by the healthcare team and that the medications are stopped immediately because of the possible implications that the development of resistance can incur.
if patients do stop therapy under those circumstances, do those mutations go away?
That's a great question. And again, we don't have over the long, long term a lot of information on this. But fortunately, and we haven't really discussed telaprevir and boceprevir specifically yet, but these are the two medications, the two protease inhibitors that were approved in the United States in May of 2011. Patients that were involved in the trials with these medications who have failed therapy, who have resistant associated variants have been followed over the long term. Now, the final presentations of these studies are not yet in, but the preliminary reports are in. And with both of the medications, it seems that over the relative short term, the population of resistant associated variants seems to return to the wild type. The vast majority of patients in under 2 years lose the resistant associated variants and the wild type returns. Now, again, there are some limitations to the testing because, again, we only can detect these RAVs if they're at a certain prevalence in the patient. But with the testing limitations that we have, it seems that we do revert back to the wild type, thank goodness. So the preliminary information is that these resistant associated variants seem to disappear over the relative short term.
And one study even looked using clonal sequencing, right, to look at this question. What did they find?
And they found the same thing. When they looked at some of the specific patients that they had been following with the population sequencing, mm-hmm. which you need larger amounts of resistant virus, where they really looked at smaller amounts, they still found that the RAVs, these resistant associated variants, seemed to disappear and that the wild type overtook those RAVs. Mm-hmm. They were less fit, the RAVs, and that you reverted back to the baseline viral population.
So given that there's no archiving as with HIV or hepatitis B, this might suggest that it's at least theoretically possible that a patient who's developed drug resistance could be treated again in the future with the same drug in a different regimen. Is that right?
Well, I don't think you'd want to treat with exactly the same regimen, because if they failed one regimen, that it's very likely to be unsuccessful in the future. But it would certainly imply, as we know from HIV as well as hepatitis B, that if you can add a complementary drug that would be active against the mutation that's likely to be selected by reintroducing the DAA that the patient had previously failed, that you could possibly control and eliminate that. I also think on the converse, though, is that it's very difficult to adhere to a futility rule. And the price of not adhering to a futility rule in the past was cost and side effects. But we now know that there is an additional cost, and we also know, most importantly, is that the futility rules truly are futility rules. That just because you've seen a nice decline in the virus, if it hasn't declined robustly, it's usually a sign that resistance has already developed. And so as hard as it is to convince your patient who's had a monumental decrease, but not quite enough of a decrease, to stop these medicines that your patient probably feels are successful, it's got to be done.
The futility rules now are much more draconian, mm-hmm. and in fact surprising to people that were adhering to the futility rules before. It's less than 1,000 international units per ml at week 4 and 12 for telaprevir, and less than 100 international units per ml at week 12 with boceprevir. So whereas we might have viral levels near those levels in the past and be happy, now we're not happy. And despite the fact that the viral level may have dropped from a million to 4,000 with telaprevir, for instance, that is a guaranteed fail. That is a violation of the futility rule if it's at the certain time. So you must check the hep C RNA at those times, and you must follow them. And if you wonder and say, well, what's the harm? Even if you just keep on the medicine, it's down a lot. In the studies, as I understand it, when patients were continued, it never worked. Mm-hmm. It never worked. And in fact, when you check a viral load the next time, it is always higher. Always. Because the patient has developed resistance, the medications that you're administering aren't working, and the virus continues to flourish over the long term. So the futility rules must be adhered to.
So those patients are not only destined to have virologic failure, but your concern is, as you've both said, that they're going to develop even more drug resistance as you continue to treat them. Is there a utility then to doing drug resistance testing at the time of virologic failure when the patient is being taken off the medications?
I think that there are lots of times that you can envision you'd want to know this, but if we had other agents that you might turn around and then re-expose the patient to, then you absolutely need to know what the person has sensitivity to and what they don't have sensitivity to. Tenofovir and bosepovir are complementary enough with enough cross-resistance that you can't use one for the failure of the other. Mm. So that if you had a person who had a failure and you tested them for resistance and you didn't see it, you'd almost just assume that it was because the test wasn't accurate enough. It should be there. I'm not sure that today we can clinically use the information that we would obtain at the discontinuation of therapy.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of questions with resistance testing. First of all, should you check it at the beginning? And the very limited data that we have so far suggests that even if you have resistance at the beginning, if you have baseline resistance, which some people do, not many, but some do, that some of them still respond. So if you did have baseline resistance, you would not withhold therapy for patients. So it probably doesn't make sense to check before you start. Then does it make sense at the end of therapy if you fail, like you mentioned? We don't really have the data on that yet. There may be times when you do, when it's a useful test, but we don't really know what to do with the information yet. And as I mentioned, if you follow the patients out for a year or two, the majority of them seem to lose their resistant associated variant that they developed anyway. So it's hard really to ascribe a clinical utility yet for resistance testing. Now, it may be true in the near future when a patient fails therapy, that it is important to know what they developed, because even if they lose the RAV over time, that if they choose another therapeutic regimen later, it may have some impact. But we don't know right yet.
You know, another interesting concept in HIV therapy is the barrier to resistance of different drugs. Some drugs may require more than one amino acid change, for example, in order to be highly resistant to a given drug. Some mutations might come with a significant fitness cost. There's also the idea that for some resistance-associated mutations, it requires more than one nucleotide change. Steve, could you explain? I understand that that's part of the reason that we may see different susceptibility of different hepatitis C genotypes to some of these medications.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. With the protease inhibitors, now with telaprevir and bosepravir, they have actually brought out something that we never really worried about before, and that is the subtype. I should mention first that these medications are only approved for genotype 1. They are not approved for genotypes 2, 3, 4, or others. One only. But one of the things that these new medications brought out is that there's now a difference in the subtype of genotype 1. And again, we always used to get this on our test results that people would have genotype 1A and genotype 1B. Some of the questions I would get is, does that matter? Mm-hmm. And my answer always was no. But now it may be yes, because genotype 1A compared to 1B have different abilities, different thresholds to develop resistance. Now remember, how you develop resistance, those changes in the lock that we mentioned earlier, are mutations of nucleotides, amino acid substitutions. And for genotype 1A, it requires only two steps, a relatively small number of mutations, so that you can develop one of these mutations that actually stick, that confer resistance. With 1B, it takes four steps. It's a much more complicated process to develop an effective mutant, RAV, to confer resistance. So 1A, in the end, is very different than 1B in terms of the development of resistant-associated variants, with the protease inhibitors, at least, telaprevir and bosepravir.
Let's just talk for a minute about what is in the pipeline. What do you two foresee as the future, the near future of Hep C therapy?
I mean, one of the strategies over the long term to prevent the development of resistance is, of course, to add more medications that have complementary modes of action. So similar to how we treat HIV, where single drugs have not been effective because of the development of resistance, where multiple complementary drugs work very well, the same, I think, will be true in hep C. And there are many drugs in the pipeline in other classes, other enzyme inhibitors, polymerase inhibitors, NS5A inhibitors, even the host target, acyclophilin. There's acyclophilin inhibitors in development. So my suspicion is there will be combinations of these medications which will improve efficacy by diminishing the development of these resistant mutations. Now, what about PEG-related interferon and ribavirin? And Nancy mentioned this before. It seems that ribavirin is still necessary. In the studies that have been done to date, when you eliminate ribavirin from the mix, there are more variants, and the sustained virologic response is lower. So it seems so far that ribavirin will still be necessary in the future. Interferon, not. Probably. There was a publication in April, or a presentation at the liver meetings in Europe, where only two oral medications were given, and without ribavirin, by the way, and over a six-month period, for null responders in genotype 1, people that had previously been on pegylated interferon and ribavirin and had no response, and they had a sustained virologic response rate after only 6 months of 4 out of 11 patients, or 36%. And in fact, there's a presentation at the liver meetings this year in San Francisco, 2011, where 10 Japanese patients with genotype 1, subtype 1B were treated with these same two oral medications only, and again without ribavirin, and all 10 of them had a sustained response. So it seems in the future, if we get the right combination of complementary medications, that we will eliminate or limit the development of resistance and may not even need interferon anymore to obtain a sustained response. And that, of course, is the holy grail in treatment of hepatitis C.
But this is also likely to come with a lot more thought in the beginning of therapy. When you only have a couple of choices and you have to use a combination of what exists, then there isn't a lot of thought outside of, is this a good fit from a cost-benefit ratio to your patient? Now we're not only differentiating between genotype 2 and 3 compared to 1, but we're talking about subtypes. This might be a place where baseline resistance testing to identify a person who is a good fit for an oral regimen or not a good fit for a certain oral regimen might play a role. So we might be coming a lot closer to the HIV world as time goes on.
So let's give some capsule advice. What would you say? How do we prevent the emergence of resistance?
Well, Nancy can certainly add to this too, but some of the concepts that the HIV doctors know, the liver doctors now need to incorporate. It is very important when you use a direct-acting antiviral agent that the medication be taken exactly as prescribed. And that means, in this case, that you must give it with pegylated interferon and ribavirin. If you have to eliminate either of those medications, for any reason, the protease inhibitor needs to go away too, or you'll develop resistance. You need to take the medication 3 times a day with food, just like it's prescribed. If you skip a lot of doses, you allow the virus a chance to increase the replication because the lock and the key are not together, and resistance can occur. You can't stop the drug for a week or two and then restart it again. This also is a bad idea. You can't dose reduce. You can't take less. Mm-hmm. This is another foreign concept for doctors a lot of times, because when you have a side effect from a medicine, our first knee reflex is to lower the dose. In this case, you cannot. You keep the dose at exactly the right dose. You try to get through or manage the side effect. And if you can't, if you're unsuccessful, then you stop the medication completely. Lowering the dose is a very bad idea. The way we can optimize therapy for hepatitis C, and it's more important than ever, is to counsel the patient properly before you start therapy.
And during therapy.
And during therapy. Mm-hmm. But you need to, I'm sure the HIV guys, I think, do this a lot. They are very education-oriented for their patients. And again, we haven't done this as much in the liver world, I would say. But now it's very, very important. And if you educate the patients and your staff understands the principles that we just discussed here tonight, you will be able to optimize, again, the therapeutic regimen that you're about to embark on.
And the great promise for these patients, of course, is that although this might require really intensive work on their part and on yours, it's treatment for a limited period of time, which may cure them of this infection.
Finite therapy with a much better sustained virologic response rate, which impacts cancer development, transplant.
And this discussion of resistance is not to imply that we should be scared to treat patients with hepatitis C, because we've been discussing about the possible perils of resistance. The bottom line is that 65% to 80% approximately of patients, if they're treated and can and do adhere to therapy and do what they're supposed to do, are now going to clear hepatitis C virus. So this is not to dissuade the doctors to treat. It's just to make them aware of how to do the best for the patient.
Great. Thank you. On that positive note, I want to thank my colleagues and thank you for participating in this activity. To proceed to the online CME test, click on the Earn CME credit link on this page.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Understanding Resistance in Chronic HCV Infection, Lessons Learned from HIV and HPV. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.